Chapter 7. Elijah Warriner was frightened as he waited for the train to pull into the station. They were at Homerton, sitting on one of the metal benches, the red paint peeling away to reveal the scabrous rust beneath, the air heavy with the scent of stale urine and the sweet tang of the joint that was being passed around. Elijah stared across the track at the side of a warehouse marked with the tag that indicated that this was their territory. LFB, in 10-foot-high neon yellow and green letters, the black outline running where rain had mixed with it before it had dried. LFB, the London Fields Boys. They ran things around here. There were six of them on the platform. Pops, the oldest and the biggest, was in charge of the little crew. The other boys were arrayed around him on the platform. Little Mark was smoking a joint with his back to the wall. Pinky had his headphones pressed against his head, the low drone of the new Plan B record leaking out. Kids and Chips were eyeing up the girls from the Gascoigne estate, who were also waiting for the train. They were all dressed in the same way, a baseball cap, a hooded top, low-slung jeans, and brand new pairs of Nikes or Reeboks. Some of them had their hoods pulled up, resting against the brim of their caps and casting their faces in dark shadow. They all wore bandanas tied around their necks. It was just before 5:30, and rush hour was just beginning. Pops put his arm around Elijah's shoulders and squeezed him hard, using his other hand to scrub at his head.
"Jaja, chill," he said. "Nothing to worry about."
Elijah managed to smile. Pops was wearing the same uniform as all the others, but he had a pair of diamond earrings, a chunky ring on each hand, and a heavy golden chain around his neck. They denoted his position as an elder, and of course, the fact that he had more money than the rest of them. Elijah watched as Pops took out his bag of weed and his packet of papers.
"My grandma taught me to build zoots, get me?"
Pop spread a copy of the Metro across his lap and arranged his things. The bag of weed, his papers, his lighter.
"This is Penguin High Grade," he said,
indicating the transparent bag and its green-brown contents. He unsealed it and tipped out a small pile.
"You need to get yourself in the right state of mind before something like this. Can't do no better than a good zoot, know what I'm saying?"
Elijah nodded.
"You blazed before?"
"Course," Elijah said, trying to be disdainful. He had already been smoking for 6 months, ever since he had started hanging out with the young LFBs on the gangways and stairwells of Blissett House. That had frightened him too, at first, and he had found that the first few drags made him retch, his eyes watering. But it was no big thing, though, and he had quickly got used to it. There was always a zoot being passed around, and he always made sure he had some. Pops laughed at his indignant response.
"Trust me, young, and you ain't blazed nothing like this."
He opened a paper and filled it with a thick line of weed. He inserted a roach, brought the packet to his lips, licked the gummed end, and sealed it. He lit the end and took a long drag, smacking his lips in appreciation. He toked again and passed the joint to Elijah.
"Go on, younger, get some."
Elijah took the joint and, aware that Pops and the others were watching him, made sure that he didn't show any nerves as he put it between his lips and sucked down deep. The smoke was acrid and strong, and he spluttered helplessly. The other boys hooted at his discomfort.
"Look at the little joker," Pinky exclaimed. "He's gonna die from all that coughing." "Hush your gums," Pops chided. "Let him enjoy himself. What do you think, younger?"
"Buzzing,"
Elijah managed.
"Yeah, man, buzzing. You know what makes it so fine?"
Elijah shook his head, still dizzy.
"Piss. The growers piss on the dirt. Makes it more potent. Gives the skunk a kick."
Elijah spluttered in disgust and almost retched again. Pops grinned at him as the train rolled towards them.
"Get your stuff together, younger. Here it comes. This is it. You want to be with us, you got to do this. Everyone has to if they want to be mandem. You ready?
Yeah.
Elijah felt a sudden blast of lightheadedness. It added to his feeling of fright, and he suddenly felt sick. He turned away from Pops, bent double, and vomited the fried chicken he had eaten 10 minutes earlier. Half-digested slops splashing between his legs, splattering against the new trainers he had robbed from the shop in Mare Street the previous day. The others hollered.
"He's sicked up all over his crepes!"
Chips exclaimed.
"Come on," Pop said. "Get yourself together. Train's here."
The line was one of the main routes into the Olympic Park, and the trains had all been cleaned up for the games. The doors opened, and commuters working at the big new shopping centre, many still wearing their corporate uniforms, spilled out onto the platform. Pops pulled up his bandana and shrugged his hood up and over his cap until all of his face was obscured, save his eyes. The others did the same and, his hand shaking, so did Elijah. Pops was behind Elijah and he pushed him into the crowded carriage, the others following behind. Elijah had seen a train get steamed before, and he knew what to expect. Pushing him further into the carriage, Pops and the others started to hoot and holler, surging down the aisle between the seats. The noise was disorientating and frightening, and none of the passengers seemed able to react. Pops barged into the space between two benches that faced each other and ripped the mobile phone from the hand of a man in a suit. The others did the same, taking phones and tablets, dipping purses from handbags, removing wallets from the inside pockets of jackets and coats, yanking necklaces until they snapped and came free. Elijah followed behind Pops, and as they went from passenger to passenger, he took the items that Pops handed back to him and dropped them into his rucksack. His fright melted away as the adrenaline burned through his body at the thrill of what they were doing, robbing and stealing, and no one was doing a damned thing to stop them. A young man in a suit stared at them as they advanced along the carriage. He had a BlackBerry in his hand.
"What are you looking at?" Pop said. "You want to get slapped up?"
The man didn't reply.
"You want to get shanked?"
Chips reached into his pocket and took out a knife with a 6-inch blade. Still, the man was silent. Elijah looked at him and recognized the fear in his eyes. He wasn't defying them. He was just too scared to do anything.
"Jack him, younger,"
Pop said to Elijah, shoving him forwards. Elijah stepped up to him.
"Give me the phone."
The man didn't resist and held it up for Elijah to take. He put it in his rucksack with all the rest. He looked down at the man, into his eyes, and made a quick, sudden movement towards him. The man flinched, expecting a blow that didn't come. Elijah had never caused that kind of reaction before. He had always been the smallest or the youngest, the butt of the joke. Just being with the LFB made all this difference. People took him seriously. He laughed, not out of malice, but out of disbelief. Little Mark was standing in the doorway, wedging the door and preventing the train from departing.
"Wedem!"
he yelled. It had only taken them a few seconds to work their way through the carriage, although it had felt like much longer. Pops pushed Elijah ahead of him as the boys surged on, the commuters parting as they piled out of the carriage. Outside, on the platform, Elijah could hear the sound of sirens from the street below. Little Mark dropped down onto the tracks and crossed over the rails to the other side, the others following after him. Elijah clambered back onto the platform, vaulted the wooden fence, and scrambled down the loosely packed earth of the embankment, sprinting down Berger Road and turning onto Wick Road, then across that and into the estate. They had grown up with the alleys and passageways and knew them all instinctively. The police would have no chance if they tried to follow them. Elijah jogged in the middle of the group, his rucksack jangling and heavy with their loot. The trepidation had disappeared, its place taken by a pulsing excitement at the audacity of what they had done. They had stormed that train, and the people inside had been scared of them. They had sat there with their posh suits and expensive gadgets, and no one had done anything. Elijah was used to being told what to do. His parents, teachers, the police. And this had been a complete reversal. He remembered the look on the face of the man with the BlackBerry. He was a grown man, a professional man, with expensive clothes and things. The kind of man who probably had an expensive flat in Dorston or Hackney or Bethnal Green, because those places were cool. And he had been frightened of him. Scared. Elijah had never experienced what it was like to be feared before. Chapter 8. Milton drove them into Hackney. The road was lined on both sides by shops owned by Turks, Albanians and Asians, all trying to sell cheap goods to people who couldn't afford them. Past fried chicken shops, garages, past a tube station, across a bridge over the A12 with cars rushing by below, past pound shops and cafes, a branch of Cash Converter, a scruffy pub. The faces of the people who walked the road bore the marks of failure. Sharon directed him to take a left turn off the main road, and they drove into an estate. They drove slowly past a single convenience store, the windows barred and a plexiglass screen protecting the owner from his patrons. Three huge tower blocks dominated the area, each of them named after local politicians from another time. An optimistic time when the buildings would have appeared bright, new and hopeful. That day had passed. They were monstrously big, almost too large to take in with a single glance. They drove around Carson House, the tower marked for demolition, its windows and doors sealed tight by bright orange metal covers. There was a playground in front of it, hooded kids sitting on the swings and slides, red-tipped cigarettes flaring in the hot, dusky light. Sharon directed Milton to Blissett House, and as he rolled the car into a forecourt occupied by battered wrecks and burnt-out hulks, the decay became too obvious to miss. Window frames were rotting, paint peeling like leprous scabs. Concrete had crumbled like meringue, the steel wires that lent support to the structure poking out like the ribs of a decaying carcass. Milton looked around. Blissett House looked like it had been built in the 50s. It would have seemed futuristic then, a brand new way of living that had risen from the grotty terraces that had been cleared away. The council finishing the job that the Germans had started. It was 20 stories high, each floor accessed by way of an external balcony that looped around a central shaft. There was a pervading sense of menace, a heavy dread that settled over everything like smog. The doors and windows were all barred. Graffitied tags were everywhere. One of the garages on the first floor level had been burned out, the metal door half ripped off and hanging askance. An Audi with blacked-out windows was parked in the middle of the wide forecourt, the door open and a man lounging in the driver's seat, his legs extending out. The baleful, rhythmic thump from a new dubstep track shuddered from the bass bins in the back of the car. Milton pointed his key at his Volvo and thumbed the lock. It seemed a pointless affectation, and the car looked vulnerable as they walked away from it. He was grateful for once for the state of it. With the exhaust lashed to the chassis with wire and the wing folded inwards from the last time he had pranged it, it was nothing to look at. It was, he hoped, hardly worth taking, or else he was going to have a long walk home. He followed Sharon towards the building. The man in the Audi stared at him through a blue-tinged cloud of dope smoke, his eyes lazy but menacing. Milton held his stare as he crossed his line of vision. The man's hair was arranged in long dreads, and gold necklaces were festooned around his neck. As their eyes met, the man nonchalantly flicked away the joint he had finished and tugged up his T-shirt to show the butt of the revolver shoved into the waistband of his jeans. Milton looked away. He didn't care that the man would consider that a small victory. There was nothing to be gained from causing trouble. Sharon led the way to the lobby. "The lifts don't work," she apologised, gesturing to the signs pasted onto the closed doors. Hope you don't mind a little climb. We're on the 6th floor. The stairwells were dank and dark and smelled of urine. Rubbish had been allowed to gather on the floor, and a pile of ashes marked the site of a recent fire. A youngster with his hood pulled up over his head shuffled over.
You're after something?
Sharon stepped up to him.
Leave off, Dwayne. Where's Jar Jar?
He asked her.
Don't you be worrying about him, she said. You tell him I want to see him.
What for?
Just tell him, you dumb sket.
Milton stepped between them. The boy was big for his age, only a couple of inches shorter than he was, and his shoulders were heavy with muscle. He squared up and faced him.
Yeah, what you want, big man?
I want you to show a little respect.
Who are you? A new boyfriend. She's grimy, man. Grimy. I seen half a dozen brothers going in and out of her place last week. She's easy, bro. Don't think you're nothing special.
The boy was making a point. He didn't know what Milton's relationship with Sharon was, and he didn't care. He was daring Milton to do something. There didn't seem to be any point in talking to him. Milton slapped him with the back of his hand, catching him by surprise and spinning him against the wall. He followed up quickly, taking the boy's right arm and yanking it hard all the way up behind his back. The boy squealed in pain as Milton folded his fingers back, guiding him around so that he faced Sharon. Apologise, he said.
Mr. Milton,
Sharon said hesitantly. Apologise, Milton ordered again. The boy gritted his teeth and Milton pulled his fingers back another inch.
Sorry, he said. Sorry, please, mister, you're breaking my fingers.
Milton turned him around so that he was facing the open door and propelled him out of it. He landed on his stomach, scraping his face against the rough tarmac. The man in the tricked-out car looked over, lazy interest flickering across his face.
You didn't need to do that, Sharon said. It's best just to ignore them.
Good manners don't cost anything. Come on, let's get you inside. I bet you could do with a cup of tea. They climbed the stairs to the 6th floor and followed the open walkway to the end of the block. A couple of youngsters were leaning against the balcony, looking out over the estate below and, beyond that, the streets and houses that made up this part of Hackney. Milton recognised from experience that they had been stationed as lookouts and that, from their perch, they would be able to see the approach of rival gangbangers or police. They would call down to the older boys selling their products on the walkways below. The dealers would vanish if it was the police, or call for muscle if it was a rival crew. Milton said nothing. The boys glared at them as they approached. Flat 609 was at the end of the block, where the walkway abutted the graffiti-marked wall. The door was protected by a metal gate, and the windows were behind similar grills. Sharon unlocked the gate and then the heavy door and went inside. Milton followed, instinctively assessing the interior. The front door opened into a tiny square hallway, one of the walls festooned with coats on a row of hooks and a dozen pairs of shoes stacked haphazardly beneath it. Post had been allowed to gather beneath the letterbox, and Milton could see that most were bills, several of them showing the red ink that marked them as final demands. The hallway had three doors. Sharon opened the one to the lounge, and Milton followed her inside. It was a large room, furnished with an old sofa, a square table with four chairs, and a large flat-screen television. Video games were scattered on the floor.
How many children do you have? Milton asked.
Two.
My oldest, Jules, fell in with the wrong sort. He has a problem with drugs. We only ever see him when he wants money. It's just me and Elijah most of the time.
Milton was a good listener, and Sharon started to feel better. Just talking to him helped. Perhaps he was right, and there was something he could do. It wasn't as if she had had any other offers of help. Social was useless, and the last thing she wanted to do was get the police involved. They wouldn't be sympathetic, and Elijah would end up with a record or something, and that would be the end of that, as far as his future was concerned.
Why don't you sit down? Milton suggested. I'm guessing this is the kitchen? She nodded. So go on, sit down and relax. I'll make you a cup of tea while we wait for your son.
Chapter 9. When Elijah opened the door to their flat, there was a white man he had never seen before sitting in the front room. He was tall, with strong-looking shoulders and large hands, and plain to look at in a loose-fitting suit and scuffed leather shoes. The scar across his face was a little frightening. He was in the armchair Elijah used when he was on his PlayStation drinking a cup of tea. Elijah's first thought was that he was police, a detective, and he suddenly felt horribly exposed. Pops had told him to take the gear they had thiefed from the people on the train and keep it safe while he arranged for someone to buy it from them. It swung from his shoulder, clanking and clicking. His mother was sitting opposite the man. She got up as he came in through the door. "Where have you been?" she said. "You're late." "Out," he replied sullenly. The man put down his cup of tea and pulled himself out of the armchair.
"Who are you?"
"This is Mr. Milton."
"I was talking to him."
Elijah looked up at the man. There was a flintiness in his icy blue eyes. Elijah tried to stare him out, but although the man was smiling at him, his eyes were cold and hard and unnerving. He made Elijah anxious.
He held out a hand.
"You can call me John," he said.
"Yeah, whatever."
The heavy rucksack slipped down his shoulder, rattling noisily. He shrugged it back into place and stepped around the man to go to his room. Sharon got to her feet and stepped in between him and his door.
"What's in the bag, Elijah?"
"Nothing, just my stuff."
"Then you won't mind me having a look, will you?"
She took the bag from him, unzipped it and, one by one, pulled out the mobile phones, watches, wallets and two tablet computers. Silently, she lined them up on the dining table and then, when she was done, turned to face him with a frightened expression on her face.
"How did you get this?"
"Looking after it for a friend."
"Did you steal it?"
"Course not,"
he said, but he knew he sounded unconvincing. He was aware of the big man in the room with them.
"Who are you?"
he asked again.
"Police?"
"Social?"
"I'm a friend of your mother.
She's worried about you."
"She needn't be, I'm fine."
Sharon held up an expensive-looking watch.
"This is all teethed, isn't it?"
"I told you I'm just looking after it."
"Then you can take it straight back to him. I don't want it in the house."
"Why don't you just mind your business?"
He dropped everything back into the rucksack and slung it across his shoulder.
"Who is it?"
she said as he turned for the door.
"You don't know him."
"Show your mother some respect," Milton said. "She doesn't deserve you speaking to her like that."
"Who are you, go telling me what to do?"
he exploded.
"I ain't never seen you before. Don't think you're anything special neither. None of her boyfriends last long. They all get bored eventually, and we don't never see them no more. I don't know who you are, and I'm not going to bother to find out. I won't ever see you again."
"Elijah!"
Milton didn't know how to respond to that, and he stepped aside as Elijah made for the door. Sharon looked on haplessly as her son opened it, stepped out onto the landing, and slammed it behind him. Chapter 10. Elijah passed through the straggled group of customers that had gathered outside the entrance to Blissett House. The boys called them cats and took them for all they were worth. They passed out their bags of weed and heroin, their rocks of crack, snatching their money and sending them on their way. They didn't get very far. One of the empty flats had been turned into a crack house, and they scurried into it. When they shuffled out again hours later, they were vacant and etiolated. Halfway human, dead-eyed zombies, already desperately working out where they would find the money for their next fix. Elijah made his way through the estate to the abandoned flat that the LFB had claimed for themselves. A family had been evicted for non-payment of rent, and now the older boys had taken it over, gathering there to drink, smoke and be with their girls. Elijah had never been inside the flat before, but he didn't know where else he could take the rucksack and the things that they had stolen. He was furious. Who was that man to tell him what to do? He didn't look like any of his mother's boyfriends. He was white for a start, but he had no reason to come and stick his nose into his business. He told himself that he wouldn't see the man again, that he'd get bored, just like they always did, and it would be him who told his mother that it didn't matter, that he would look after her. He had been the man in the house ever since his older brother had vanished. He had been grown up about it all. He'd had to. There wasn't anyone else. The flat was in the block opposite Blissett House. Elijah idled on the walkway, trying to muster the courage to turn the corner and approach the doorway. It was on the 11th floor and offered a panoramic view of the area. He looked beyond the estate, across the hodgepodge of neater housing that had replaced two other blocks that had been pulled down 5 years ago, past the busy ribbon of Mare Street and across East London to glittering Olympic Park beyond. He rested his elbows on the balcony and gazed down at their flat. His bedroom had a window that looked out onto the walkway. He remembered lying in bed at night and listening as the older boys gathered outside, the lookouts that were posted to watch for the police or other boys. They would talk about money, about the things they would buy, about girls. They talked for hours until the sweet smell of weed wafted in through the open window and filled the room. Elijah's mother would occasionally hustle outside, shooing them away, but they always came back, and, over time, she gave up. It was intoxicating. The boys seemed special to Elijah. They were cool. They were older. They had money. They weren't afraid of girls. They talked about dealing drugs and teefing, the kind of things that Elijah's favourite rappers rapped about. It was a lifestyle that was glamorous beyond the day-to-day drudgery of school and then helping his mother with the flat. It didn't seem wrong to want a little bit of it for himself. The boys knew Elijah could hear them, and eventually they started to include him in their conversations. It wasn't long until he opened the window all the way and started talking to them. He asked how he could get his own money. They told him to stand watch for them, and he did. When they came back, they gave him a brand new PSP. The week after that, they gave him money. He had never seen a £50 note before, but they pressed one into his hand. They started to talk to him more often. They offered him his first joint. He spluttered helplessly as he tried to smoke it, and they laughed at him as he desperately tried to look cool. It wasn't long before they gave him the chance to make more money. He was small, with tiny arms that could fit through car windows that had been left open. He would open the locks from the inside, and the boys would tear out the car stereos and steal anything else that had been left behind, GPS devices, handbags. They would steal 6 or 7 a night, and Elijah would be given £50. He put the cash in a shoebox that he hid under his bed. His mother never asked where he got the money for his new clothes. Elijah knew that she wasn't stupid. She just didn't want to hear him say it. He watched as the door opened and the white man stepped outside. Elijah watched him make his way along the walkway and, after descending the stairs, emerge out onto the forecourt. He walked towards a beaten-up old car, pausing at the door and then crouching down at the front wheel. Elijah could tell from the way the car slumped to the side that the tyre had been slashed. He grinned as the man took off his jacket, removed a spare from the boot, and started to go about changing it. A couple of the older boys were smoking joints on the walkway.
All right, younger.
The boy's real name was Dylan, but they called him Fat Boy on account of how big he had been as a young teenager. He had grown out of that now. He was 19, 6 foot tall, and full of muscle.
His pop's here.
He's inside. What do you want?
I need to see him.
All right, bruv. He's in the back. Knock when you get in.
The flat had been taken over by the LFB. They had sprayed their tag on every spare wall, and a huge, colourful version filled the wall in the lounge. Boys from the estate lounged around, some playing FIFA on a stolen flat-screen television. Others were listening to the new album from Wretch, arguing that it was better or worse than the new tracks from Newham Generals or Professor Green. Trash was shoved into the corners. Empty paper bags from McDonald's, chicken bones that had been sucked clean, empty cigarette packets, cigarette papers. Everyone was toking, and Elijah quickly felt dizzy from the dope smoke that rolled slowly through the room. A couple of the boys looked up, clocked him, ignored him again. No one acknowledged him. The room was hectic and confusing with noise. Elijah felt young and vulnerable, but dared not show it.
"Look who it is!" whooped little Mark. "Baby Jaja!"
Pinky sneered.
"It's late, younger. Shouldn't you be tucked up in bed?"
"Leave him alone," kids chided.
Elijah reluctantly made his way across the room to them. Little Mark's real name was Edwin, and he lived in a flat on the 7th floor of Blissett House with his dad. Elijah did not know kids' real name, only that he lived in Regis House and had a reputation as the most prolific mugger in the crew. Pinky's real name was Shaquille. He was usually quiet and surly and had a nasty reputation. Elijah tried to keep his distance whenever he was around.
"What are you doing here?"
kids said as he came alongside them.
"Came to see Pops," he said.
Pinky nodded to the rucksack across his shoulder.
"Afraid your mum finds out what you got in there?"
"I ain't afraid," Elijah said.
"That's from earlier, right? The gear from the train?"
"Yes."
"What you bring it with you for then? You stupid or something?"
"I ain't stupid either.
Look pretty stupid from where I'm sitting."
Kids smiled at him indulgently.
"Are you going to explain it if you get pulled by the feds?"
Elijah felt himself blush.
"Told you was stupid," Pinky said. "Stupid little kid. He ain't right for LFB."
"Lucky for him, that's not for you to decide then, innit?"
"Ignore him, young'un. Pops is in the back. Go on through."
Elijah made his way through the room. The layout of the flat was identical to his own, and he guessed that Pops was in the main bedroom. He knocked on the door. A voice called that he could come in. The room was dark. Pops was standing next to the open window, blowing smoke into the dusky light beyond. He had removed his shirt, and his muscular torso glistened with a light film of sweat. He had a tattoo of a dragon across his shoulders, and, on his bicep, the letters L, F and B. His heavy gold chain glittered against the darkness of his skin. A white woman sat on the edge of the mattress they had put in the room. She straightened her skirt as she got to her feet. She was older than Pops, looked like she was in her 30s, and dressed like the office workers from the city who had seeped into the smarter parts of the borough. Elijah had heard about her. The rumour was that she was something in the city, and that she had a taste for the crack. Pops crossed the room and kissed her gently on the cheek.
"I see you tonight," he said.
She ran her palm across his cheek, collected her jacket, and left the room. Pops found his T-shirt and pulled it over his head. Elijah caught himself wondering how old he was. His brown skin was unmarked, his eyes bright and intense. Elijah guessed he was 18 or 19, but he had a hardness about him that made him seem older. It was a forced maturity, a product of the road, of the things he had seen and done. It had flayed the innocence out of him.
"What's the matter, younger?"
"My mum caught me with this," he said, shrugging the rucksack from his shoulder and letting it hang before him. "She'll nick it off me if I have it in the house."
Pops laughed.
"Don't fret about it, younger. We'll look after it here."
He took the bag and tossed it onto the mattress.
"Fucking day. I'm all done in."
He took a bag of weed from his pocket and found a packet of rolling papers on the windowsill.
"You want a smoke?"
Elijah had never been alone with Pops before.
He was talking to him, taking him seriously, and it made him feel special.
Go on then, he said, trying to sound older than he felt.
Pops busied himself with making the spliff.
You have fun this afternoon, Blood?
Yeah.
You nervous?
Elijah took the joint and put it to his lips as Pop sparked it for him.
A bit.
That's okay, he said. It's all right to be nervous. Nerves mean adrenaline, and adrenaline is good. Keeps you sharp. You were quick when Boyd M came, away on your toes.
I've always been good at running, he said.
That's the thing, younger. That's going to be useful. You can't never let the feds get hold of you. The thing that keeps me running, even when my lungs are burning like someone sparked up a spliff in my chest, even when the stubborn side of me wants to turn around and get ignorant, face them like a man, that's when I remember I've already spent way too many nights sitting on a blue rubber mattress in a cell. Who knows how many times it's been pissed on. That's when I remember getting caught by Boydem's a no-no. You can't come back to the manor and big up your chest about getting shift by Boydem. Bad boys ain't supposed to get caught, Jar Jar. Especially not black boys. He grinned at him. It's all good. You did good.
Elijah felt a blast of pride that made his heart skip. No one had said anything like that to him before. His teachers thought he was a waste of space. He didn't have a dad, and his mum was always nagging. He drew in on the joint, coughing as the smoke hit his lungs.
We ain't really talked before, have we?
Elijah shrugged. Not much.
What are you going to do with your life, little man?
The question caught him off guard.
Dunno,
he said.
You got no plans? No dreams?
Dunno. Maybe football. I'm not bad, maybe that.
Maybe football,
Pops repeated, smiling, taking the joint as Elijah passed it back to him.
I'm okay at it,
Elijah said defensively, wondering if he was being gently mocked. I'm pretty fast.
I'll see ya,
Pops said, taking a long toke on the joint.
You like the Usain Bolt of acne.
Pops dropped down on the mattress. He patted the space next to him and Elijah sat too. It might have been the weed, but he felt himself start to relax.
Listen, younger, I'm going to tell you something. You won't think it's cool, but I know what I'm talking about, and you do yourself a favour to listen, all right?
He settled back so that he was leaning against the wall.
It's good to have dreams, but a man needs a plan, too. Maybe you are decent at football. Maybe you are good enough to make it. But how many kids do you know from these ends who have done it? Maybe you can think of one, but I don't know any. Football is a dream, right? And like I say, it's good to have dreams. But a man's got to have a plan too. A realistic one. Just in case his dreams don't pay off. You know what I'm saying?
What about the street?
Seriously, younger? The street can be a laugh. You don't get too deep into it. But the street ain't no plan.
You're doing it.
Only for now. It's not a long-term thing.
I know people who do all right.
The kids shot in drugs.
Nah, that's just baby steps. I mean the ones above them.
Listen to me, Elijah. There ain't no future on the street. Some brothers do make it through. I know some who started off as young as like you, younger than you. Then they work their way up with shotting and teething until they become elders, and then some of them keep out of trouble long enough and get made faces. But you look, every year, some of them get taken out. Some get lifted by the feds, others ain't so lucky, and those ones get shot and end up in the ground, like Darwin, innit? Survival of the fittest. You want, we could have a little experiment. We could start with 100 young boys, kids your age, and I reckon if we came back 5 years later to see how they'd be getting on, maybe one or two of them would still be making their way from the street. The others are out, one way or another, banged up or brown bread.
I don't know what you're like when it comes to numbers, but me, it's like how you are at football. I ain't too bad at all.
I'm telling you, younger,
100-1 or 2 ain't odds I'm that excited about. What about today? You were out with us?
I know. You think I sound like a hypocrite, and that's fair enough. Maybe I am. But I ain't saying stealing stuff is bad. It ain't right that some people have everything they want and others, people like us. It ain't right that we don't have shit. That stuff we nicked today, them people was all insured. We gave them a scare, but they didn't actually lose nothing. They'll get it all back, all shiny and new. We deserve a nice phone, a camera, an iPod, whatever, and we ain't gonna get it unless we take it. I reckon that's fair enough. I reckon that makes it all right to do what we did, but it ain't got a future. You do it 10 times, 20 times, maybe if you get lucky. Eventually you're going to get nicked. Someone gets pulled and grasses you up. Your face gets on CCTV. The feds have got to do something about it in the end. See, what we did this afternoon is short term. If you want to have those things properly without fear that they're going to get taken away from you and you're going to get banged up, then there ain't nothing else for it. You got to play the game by their rules. How? You've got to study. You've got to get your exams.
You probably think I'm high saying that. He nodded at the joint, smiled, and then handed it across. But think about it a little, and you know I'm talking sense. I didn't pay no attention at school. I was a disaster. I couldn't stand it, so I hardly went at all. And I couldn't wait until I was old enough so that I didn't have to do no more. I'm older now. I've got more experience. And I'm telling you that all that stuff they say about studying is true. If I'd paid attention more, did better, what I'm trying to do with myself now would have been a million times easier. Elijah was confused. What are you doing?
So I said I was okay with numbers? Always have been. Just something I've got a talent for.
I'm going to night school to get my A-level. Maths. You know my woman. You know what she does. Elijah had heard. Something in the city. He nodded. Accountant. She says if I can get my exams, she can get me a job with her firm. Nothing special, not to start with. Post room or some shit like that, but it's a foot in the door. A chance to show them what I can do. After that, who knows? But I tell you this for nothing, younger. I ain't going to be doing what we did this afternoon for much longer.
Elijah sucked on the joint again, stifling the unavoidable cough. The conversation had taken him by surprise. He had always looked up to Pops, thought that he was cool, and he was the last person he would have expected to tell him to stay in school and work hard.
You did good today. Like I said, you got potential. I saw it in you right away.
That one easy. I remember my first time. I was sick as a dog. They had to push me onto the bus and then I was completely useless. None of that with you, was there? You got balls. That's great. But just think about what I've said, all right? There's no future there for you, for any of us.
They smoked the rest of the joint together before Pops got up.
I got a breeze, got school. My exams are in a month and we're revising. Equations and all that shit, don't want to be late.
The night was warm and close and the walkway was empty as they both stepped outside. Pops bumped fists with him and descended the stairs. Elijah rested his elbows on the balustrade, looking across to Blissett House and his mother's flat, then down into the yard as Pops emerged, walking confidently and with purpose, acknowledging the monosyllabic greetings from the strung-out cats and the boys from the gang who sold them their gear. Pops was liked, respected. Elijah nodded to himself. He fancied some of that himself. Part 2. Murder Mile. He wiped the sweat from his face and put the scope of his rifle to his eye, gazing down onto the plains below. The village was 500 yards away, clustered around the river. 2 dozen huts, the villagers making their living from the herd of goats that grazed on the scrappy pasture to the north and west. It was a small habitation gathered around a madrasa. Children played in the dusty yard outside, kicking a ball, a couple of them wearing the shirts of teams he recognised. He took a breath and held it, the rifle held steady, the stock pressed into the space between his shoulder and neck. He nudged the rifle left to right, examining each hut individually. Nothing was out of place. The women were working at home, while the men tended the animals in the pasture. He moved the scope right to left until the missile launcher was centred in the crosshairs. A Scud launcher, an old R-11, Russian-made. He squinted down the sight, placing each member of the crew. Three men, Republican Guard. He centred each man in the crosshairs, his finger held loosely through the trigger guard, the tip trailing against the edge of the trigger. He nudged the scope away again, so that he could focus on the madrasa. Five children in the yard, their cheap plastic ball jerking in the wind as they kicked it against the wall of the hut. They were happy. The launcher meant nothing to them, nothing compared to their game and the fun they could have together. He heard their laughter delivered to him by a welcome breath of air. Chapter 11. John Milton awoke at 6 the next morning. He had slept badly, the damned nightmare waking him in the middle of his deepest sleep and never really leaving after that, the ghostly after-effects playing across his mind. He reached out to silence his alarm and allowed himself the rare luxury of coming around slowly. His thoughts turned to the previous evening, to Sharon and Elijah. He recognised elements of his own personality in the boy, the stubbornness and the inclination to resist authority. If they lived under different circumstances, it would have done no harm for the boy to test her limits. It was natural, and he would have returned to her in time. Their circumstances did not allow him that freedom, though. Milton could see how the attraction of the gang would be difficult for him to resist. If he allowed himself to be drawn into their orbit, he risked terrible damage to his prospects, a criminal record if he was lucky, or if he wasn't, something much worse. Milton did not own or rent a property. It was unusual for him to be in the country for long periods, and he didn't see the point of it. He preferred to be unencumbered, flexible enough to be able to move quickly whenever required. His practice was to stay in hotels, so he had booked a room in an American chain, an anonymous space that could have been anywhere in the world. The hotel was on the south bank of the Thames next to Westminster Bridge, and when he pulled the curtains aside, he was presented with a view of the pigeons and air conditioning units on the roof of the adjacent building and, beyond that, the tower of the Houses of Parliament. The sky above was cerulean blue, and, once again, the sun was already blazing. It was going to be another hot day. He showered and shaved, standing before the mirror with a towel around his waist. He was 6 foot tall and around 13 stone, with an almost wiry solidity about him. His eyes were on the grey side of blue, his mouth had a cruel twist to it. There was a long horizontal scar from his cheek to the start of his nose, and his hair was long and a little unkempt, a frond falling over his forehead in a wandering comma. There was a large tattoo of angel wings spread across his shoulders, claws at the tips, and rows of etched feathers descending down his back until they disappeared beneath the towel. It was the souvenir of a night in Guatemala, out of his mind on Quetzalteca Especial and mescaline. Milton dressed and went down to the restaurant for breakfast. He found a table to himself and filled his plate with scrambled eggs from the buffet. He drank a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice, poured a cup of strong coffee, and flicked through the pages of the Times. The front page was dominated by news of the killing in France. The gendarmerie were waiting to speak to the boy. It was hoped that he would be able to tell them what had happened and, perhaps, identify the man who had killed his parents. Milton folded the paper and put it to one side. He returned to his room and packed. He had very little in the way of possessions, but what he did own was classic and timeless. A wide, flat gunmetal cigarette case, a black oxidized Ronson lighter, a Rolex Oyster perpetual watch. There was little else. He smoked a cigarette out of the window as he transferred his clothes from the wardrobe to his suitcase, put on a pair of Levi's and a shirt, slipped his wallet and phone into his pocket, and took the lift down to reception. "I'd like to check out, please," he told the receptionist. She keyed his details into her computer.
"Certainly, Mr. Anderson. How was your stay with us?"
"Very pleasant." He settled the bill in cash, collected the Volvo from the underground car park, and drove back to Hackney. He drove through the square mile, its clean streets, well-shod denizens, steepling towers and minarets, a gleaming testament to capitalism. He continued past Liverpool Street, through trendy Shoreditch, and then passed into the hinterland beyond. Milton had noticed the arcade of shops as he had driven home last night. There was an estate agent's between a fried chicken takeaway and a minicab office. He parked and walked along the arcade, pausing to look at the properties advertised in the window. He went inside, and a man in a cheap, shiny suit asked him if he could be of help.
"I'm looking for a place to rent."
"Furnished or unfurnished?"
"Furnished."
"Anywhere in particular?" "We've got a nice place in a school conversion near to the station."
"Somewhere close to Blissett House."
The man looked at him as if he was mad.
"That's not the best area. It's rough."
"That's all right."
"Do you work in the city?"
"No, I'm a writer," he said, using the cover story he had prepared as he had travelled across London. "I'm researching a book on police corruption. I need to be in the middle of things. I don't care if it's rough. It's better if it's authentic. Do you have anything?"
The man flicked through his folder of particulars, evidently keen not to look a gift horse in the mouth.
"We just had a place come up on Grove Road. Terraced house, two bedrooms. I wouldn't say it's anything special, but it's cheap, and it's on the edge of the estate. Best I can do, I'm afraid. Most stock in the blocks themselves are kept back for council tenants."
"Can you show me?"
"Of course."
The maisonette was close to the office, and since it was a bright, warm day, they walked. The hulk of Blissett House loomed over them as they passed beneath the railway line and into an estate that had been cleared, the brutalist blocks replaced by neat and tidy semi-detached houses. They were painted a uniform pale orange, and each had its own little scrap of garden behind a metal fence. Some houses were occupied by their owners and marked by careful maintenance. Others were rented, distinguished by overgrown lawns that stank of dog excrement, boarded windows and wheelie bins that overflowed with trash. They continued on, picking up Grove Road. The house that the agent led them to was the last in a terrace that was in a poor state of repair. It was a tiny sliver of a house, only as wide as a single window and the front door. Solid metal security gates had been fitted to the doors and windows. Graffiti had been sprayed on the walls, and the remains of a washing machine had been dumped and left to rust in the street right next to the curb. The agent unlocked the security door and yanked it aside. The property was Spartan. A small lounge, kitchen and bathroom on the ground floor, and two bedrooms above. The furniture was cheap and insubstantial. The room smelt of fried food and stale urine.
"It's a little basic," the agent said,
not even bothering to try to pretend otherwise.
"I'm sorry, we have other places, though. I've got the key for another one, much nicer, 10 minutes away."
"This'll do," Milton said. "I'll take it."
Chapter 12. It took half an hour back at the office for the formalities of the lease to be taken care of. Milton paid the deposit and the advance rent in cash. There were no references or credit checks required, which was just as well, since a search of Milton's details would not have returned any results. The agent asked him whether he was sure that the house was what he wanted, and again offered a handful of alternatives that he thought would be more appropriate. Milton politely declined the offer, thanked him for his help, took the keys, and left the office. There was a small mini-market serving the area. It was sparsely stocked, a few bags of crisps and boxes of cereal displayed under harsh strip lights that spat and fizzed. Alcohol and cigarettes, however, were well provided for, secured behind the Perspex screen from behind which the owner surveyed his business with suspicious eyes. Milton nodded to the man as he made his way inside and received nothing but a wary tip of the head in return. He made his way through the shop, picking out cleaning products, a carton of orange juice, and a bag of ice. He took his goods to the owner and arranged them on the lip of the counter ahead of the screen. As the man rang his purchases up, Milton looked behind him to shelves that were loaded with alcohol, gin, vodka, whiskey. The owner caught his glance. "You want?" He paused and almost wavered. 692 days, he reminded himself. 692 going on 693. He needed a meeting badly. "No, just those, please." Milton paid and returned to the maisonette. He unlocked the doors and scraped the security door against the concrete lintel as he yanked it aside. It didn't take long to establish himself. He unpacked in the larger of the two bedrooms, hanging the clothes in a wardrobe made of flimsy sheets of MDF. He spread his sleeping bag out across the lumpy mattress, went downstairs to the kitchen, and took out the mop and bucket he found in a small cupboard. He filled the bucket with hot water, added detergent, and started to attack the layers of grease that had stratified across the cheap linoleum floor. It took Milton 6 hours to clean the house, and even then he had only really scratched the surface. The kitchen was presentable, the floor was clean, the fridge and oven had been scoured to remove the encrusted stains, the utensils, crockery, and surfaces were scrubbed until the long-neglected dirt had been ameliorated. There were mouse droppings scattered all about, but save clearing them away, there was nothing that Milton could do about that. He moved on to the bathroom, spending an hour scrubbing the toilet, the sink and the bath, and washing the floor. When he was finally finished, he undressed and stood beneath the shower, washing in its meagre stream of warm water until he felt clean. He put on a fresh T-shirt and jeans, took his leather jacket from where he had hung it over the banister, went outside and locked the door behind him. He set off for the main road. He took out his phone and opened the bookmarked page on his internet browser. He double-tapped an icon and his mapping application opened. His destination was a 3-mile walk away. He had an hour before the meeting and it was a hot evening. He decided that rather than take the bus, he would walk. St. Mary Magdalene Church was on the left-hand side of the road, set back behind a low brick wall, well-trimmed topiary, and a narrow fringe of grass studded with lichen-covered gravestones from 100 years ago. A sign had been tied to the railings, two capital A's set inside a blue triangle that was itself set within a blue circle. An arrow pointed towards the church. Milton felt a disconcerting moment of doubt and paused by the gate to adjust the lace of his shoe. He looked up and down the street, satisfying himself that he was not observed. He knew the consequences for being seen in a place like this would be draconian and swift. Suspension would be immediate, the termination of his employment would follow soon after, and there was the likelihood of prosecution. He was ready to leave the service, but on his own terms, and not like that. He passed through the open gate and followed a gravel path around the side of the building, descended a flight of stairs, and entered the basement through an open door. The room inside was busy with people and full of the noise of conversation. A folding table had been set up and arranged with a vat of hot water, two rows of mismatched mugs, a plastic cup full of plastic spoons, jars of coffee, and an open box of tea bags, a large two-pint container of milk, a bowl of sugar, and a plate of digestive biscuits. The man behind the table was black and heavy-set, with a well-trimmed salt-and-pepper beard and hair cropped close to his scalp. His arms bulged with muscle, and his shirt was tight around his chest and shoulders. Milton approached the table.
"Can I get you a drink?"
the man said. "Coffee, please." The man smiled, took one of the mugs, and added two spoonfuls of coffee granules.
"Haven't seen you before."
"My first time." The man poured hot water into the mug.
"Your first meeting here, or your first ever?"
"First time here."
"All right, then,"
the man said. A silence extended, but before it could become uncomfortable, the man filled it.
"I'm Rutherford,"
he said.
"Dennis Rutherford. But everyone just calls me Rutherford."
"John."
"Nice to meet you, John."
He handed him the mug.
"Help yourself to biscuits. The meeting's about to get started. It's busy tonight. Go in and get a seat if I were you."
Milton did. The adjacent room was larger, with a low sloping ceiling and small windows that were cut into the thick brick walls that served as foundations for the church above. A table had been arranged at one end with two chairs behind it, and the rest of the space was filled with folding chairs. A candle had been lit on the table, and tea lights had been arranged on window sills and against the wall. The effect was warm, intimate, and atmospheric. Posters had been stuck to the walls. One was designed like a scroll with 12 separate points set out along it. It was headed, "The 12 Steps to Recovery." Milton took a seat near the back and sipped the cheap coffee as the chairs around him started to fill. A middle-aged man, wearing a black polo neck top and jeans, sat at one of the chairs behind the table at the front of the room. He banged a spoon against the rim of his mug, and the quiet hush of conversation faded away.
"Thank you," the man said. "Good to see so many of you. I'm glad you could come. Let's get started. My name is Alan, and I'm an alcoholic."
Milton sat quietly at the back of the room. Alan was the chairman, and he had invited another speaker to address the group. The second man said that he was a lawyer from the city and told his story. It was the usual thing. A man who appeared to be successful was hiding a barrage of insecurities behind addictions to work and drink. A tactic that had worked for years, but now was coming at too high a price. Family, relationships, his health. The message was cliched. Milton had heard it all before, 1,000 times before. Yet the passion with which the man spoke was infectious. Milton listened avidly, and when he looked at his watch at the end of the man's address, half an hour had passed. The floor was opened after that, and the audience contributed with observations of their own. Milton felt the urge to raise his hand and speak, but he had no idea how best to start his story. He never did. Even if he had been able to tell it, he would not have known where to start. There was so much that he would not have been able to relate. He felt the usual relief to be there, the same sense of peace that he always felt, but it was something else entirely to put those thoughts into words. How would the others feel about his history, the things that he had done? It made him feel secretive, especially compared to the searing honesty of those around him. They talked openly and passionately, several of them struggling through tears of anger and sadness. Despite the sure knowledge that he belonged there with them, his inability to take part made him feel like a fraud.